This is the Dream Freedom Beauty Podcast, and I'm your hostess, Natalie Ross. This week's guest is Ayanna Young, who is the producer and hostess of the For the Wild podcast. For the Wild is also a 501c nonprofit organization, and we will get more into what happens under this organization, including the 1 Million Redwoods Project, which is exactly as it sounds. And For the Wild, Ayanna's podcast here, is an amazing show. If you aren't already listening to it, I hope you will. She explores rediscovery of wild nature, ecological renewal and resistance, and healing from the trauma of individualistic society on her show. It was formerly known as Unlearn and Rewild, so you may have come across it at some point, but go check it out. It's on iTunes, any Android app. You can find it, For the Wild. Before we get into this week's show, I want to share a little bit of my experience working with Rebecca Conrad, who does our monthly energy reports. But she's also an energy healer, and I have had the great joy of working with her over phone. It was just, she's in New York, I'm in North Carolina, so no need to fly up there and see her. I just picked up the phone and we had a session, and oh my goddess, I wish I had had this session like months earlier. It was not only a reflection of those things that I was believing were true, but I wasn't quite sure. They were reflected right back at me in a very clear way that gave me trust in myself, trust in my intuition, and trust in my process. And she was also able to help me pinpoint some areas where I'm struggling and how to help clear some of that interference and weirdness around these struggles. And I can say that it was extremely relaxing to work with her. It was really just affirming. And I have like 5 pages of notes from our conversation where we dove into some of my struggles and fears around creating this new show, The Self-Care Club, which is coming out soon, everybody. Stay tuned. But, oh my gosh, it's just every intuitive needs somebody, whether it's Rebecca or someone else, to act as a mirror for them. So everyone who is intuitive and empathic needs someone in their life who they can trust, who can look at them honestly and reflect back to them honestly exactly what they need to see and hear to embody their fullest truth and to really move forward in clarity and love and trust. Because when we are moving forward in clarity, love, and trust, we are moving forward in our purpose. And that's where the magic is, y'all. This is so critical. So I can just say I love working with Rebecca. I've loved working with her for the energy reports, and I've really, really, really loved working with her for this personal session. And I recommend you check her out. Check out RebeccaConran.com, RebeccaConran.com, to get more information. And while you're there, make sure you sign up for her mailing list, because she sends out really great information about the energies happening around astrological events and just around the collective consciousness as it is influencing our personal experiences. So check her out, Rebecca Conran. Thank you, Rebecca, and thank you, listeners, and everybody. I cannot say it enough times. Find somebody you trust to help support you in your clarity, in your truth, and in your healing journey so that you can really, truly embody who you are to its fullest, to your fullest. I hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to the show, Ayanna.
Thank you, Natalie. This is so wonderful to be able to spend some time together this morning.
Totally. I'm really excited to get to dive more into what you're working on out there in that beautiful, beautiful Redwood Forest area. And before we get started, I'm going to invite listeners and ourselves to close your eyes if it's safe to do so. If it's not, keep them open. And become aware of your breathing. Notice yourself breathing in And notice on your out-breath the experience of allowing yourself to relax and release any tension you're holding in your body. Without forcing anything, just become aware of your breath and allow it to guide your attention back into your body. And on the next out-breath, allow any tension you're carrying to dissolve and melt away. And remember, you can return to this awareness of your breath at any time, any place. It's all you need to do to take a step back into your body and back into centeredness, awareness, and groundedness, and back into you so you can come from a place of fullness. This one little exercise can help change everything. If only you remember to do it. Oh, so I'm so excited to talk with you, Ayana, and gosh, I wish I could be there to record you in your place because it's so beautiful out in that forest, but I'm grateful to be talking across the country here as we are. And will you share with listeners where you are?
So I am in the coastal Redwood Range of Northern California, about 6 miles from the ocean as the crow flies, in a very mountainous zone. And I love to describe it as where the redwood meets the madrone. And so although there's many redwoods here, it's an incredible community of all sorts of varieties of plants and huckleberries and alders and redwoods, Doug fir, chinkapin, canyon oak, tan oak, manzanita, calypso orchid, wild ginger, just incredible creatures that are my family and friends. And just speaking about them makes me want to tear up a little bit out of such a deep love and gratitude for them in my life.
Beautiful. And for anyone who hasn't been there, you can go to her website, forthewild.world, and see some pictures so you can get a sense of what it looks like out there, or just, you know, type in some keywords and search for that and check it out, or just go there. I mean, it's amazing. It's gorgeous up there. It's truly a paradise. But all is not well in paradise, right? So there's some threats to this ecosystem. And so something that you're doing is this incredible 1 million redwood project. Can you tell us what that is and what really sparked the inspiration to do this?
Absolutely. Well, I want to start by talking about some of the threats in case some of the listeners aren't aware of them. Well, one thing we can look, something really recent, is the fires that have been happening in Mendocino, Sonoma, Napa, and Lake counties, which is all in this North Bay zone. And that is definitely a threat, not just to people and houses and businesses and vineyards and farms, but to the actual forest genome and to the living libraries, these forests that carry the seeds. And so when we're looking at climate change and we're seeing so many issues that are brought on, and it's not really climate change. I mean, I've been really thinking about this lately. Climate change is just a natural response to industrial extractive industry, which is fossil fuel extraction and burning of these gases, methane and carbon. So really climate change isn't the enemy here. But as we are seeing climate change ramp up, we're seeing catastrophic fires, we're seeing droughts. And then you compound that with land development, land use change, which is you'd have, say, an old growth forest that then gets logged and then gets turned into a suburb and chain stores. Ugh. And so you're losing not only biodiversity, but you're losing water storage in the ground, which is water hydrology. You're losing the soil. You're losing carbon in the soil. You're losing the chance to sequester carbon through trees and plants. And so we're really in this incredible time on the planet and in forest systems where forests are being destroyed all the time through logging and land use change. And on top of that, we continue to burn more and more fossil fuels every year. And then we have the positive feedback loops of climate change that is just making it more and more difficult for forest species to survive in a changing climate because they can't adapt. They can't evolve as fast as the climate is changing. So it's a really intense time to be awake and to be in love with the earth, because to feel such depth is heartbreaking. And it's my little dog outside. She feels it.
She agrees.
She agrees. And but I want to say to the listeners, whoever's in on this conversation, that this heartbreak is so, in my eyes, mandatory to feel. Mm-hmm. Because when you love something and you see that it's being destroyed, of course you feel bad. When you're feeling the pains of social injustices and environmental injustices and you don't feel bad, there's something wrong there. Then you're not actually being connected to what is going on, that you're not really looking at the truth. So I really want to invite these feelings of grief and overwhelm and sadness and heartbreak into our bodies, because that to me is love. And then I can actually go to the forest and I can say, I love you. I actually feel you. I feel in my own body such a desperation and urgency and sadness over what's happening to you. And that's how I can actually devote my life, is because I allow those feelings in. And so, you know, you've asked about the 1 million Redwood Project, and that came out of this desire to help, to actually be in reciprocity with this land in particular, but really with the earth, and more particularly the temperate rainforest zone, or Cascadia, which is this bioregion of the Pacific slope of the temperate rainforest, but it could also be into like the valley, the Mount Hood area, and the Cascade Mountains. And so just to kind of give you a backstory of how I came to this and how I came to actually getting into forestry, which wasn't something that I had trained for in my undergraduate studies or even really realized that I would actually be devoting my life to. But when I left New York City, after I totally shattered my identity and radicalized myself and politicized myself in Occupy Wall Street, and that's where I started the Environmentalist Solidarity Working Group, and I'd never been a political organizer before, but that kind of gave me this intense jolt of passion and rage and involvement in the political system. And although I was really engaged and interested in this global understanding of the economy and politics and trade and like kind of how we got to this place and the uneven wealth distributions and land stealing and imperialism and colonialism and patriarchy and all of the isms and all of the archies and really understanding the intellectual part of it, I never actually learned from the land or nature themselves. So that was my next step. And that's when I moved out to Oregon and I started a little organic farm on this amazing little mountaintop with a little cedar cabin that I lived in. And I started studying herbalism. And I became a commercial mushroom hunter, really never having any of these skill sets before.
Sounds like something you would need to like be passed down from your family or a mentor. But that's maybe we'll get into that a little later.
Yeah. Well, it definitely wasn't passed down from my family. I grew up completely suburban. And then I went into urban New York City, Los Angeles, San Francisco. And I didn't grow up with any of that. And we can talk about that in more depth.
That's so funny.
And so it was a really odd, you know, to some of people who knew me, kind of an odd change, like what? But what was so incredible was, especially with commercial mushroom hunting, I would be in the forest all day long and I'd be exploring the forest. And I drove all through Washington and Oregon and California and British Columbia, visiting these forests. And I learned so much about forestry. I learned so much about what a healthy ecosystem looks like versus what a damaged landscape looks like. And for those of you who do spend time in forests, you might have felt this huge change between an old growth or even a second growth forest that's been left to regrow in a healthy understory, diversity, not just diversity in plant species, but also diversity in ages, an uneven age stand is what they call it, versus when you go into a plantation forest, which is all one tree, they're all the same age, there's no understory plants, they're very crowded, there's a lot of branches, it's very dark. It's usually been sprayed with some type of fungicide, insecticide. It's usually been put into unnatural fertilizers, which then get into the waterways. And on top of that, even as these poisons are getting into the waterways are actually much smaller than they used to be, because when you do clear cut, especially around rivers and creeks, you actually create this huge issue with sedimentation and erosion. Because you could imagine if you had a bank of a river and that soil's all being held by all the plants and the tree roots. And then you cut that tree and you rip out the root systems. And then all that soil has nowhere to go but down into the creek. And then it causes this sedimentation. It actually kills salmon because the little, you know, rocks and soil get into their gills. It also covers up their breeding ground so they can't lay their eggs anymore. And it changes the shape and the shallowness of the waterway. On top of the fact that the trees and the plants actually hold water into the ground. And so when we cut those down, not only are we having the sun and the sky beat down to dry out the soil and kill the microbes, but also we don't have these incredible plant allies that are holding the water hydrology in the soil. And so when we think about rivers and creeks, yeah, sure, rain helps fill them up. But a lot of the water is actually coming from underground. And that's how it seeps up is, and you can think about springs. Springs are underground water sources that spout out at certain points. So it's this, you know, and these are not things, like I said, I didn't know these things. These are things that I could learn from observation that I really believe that anybody could learn from observation, because we are biologically born as earth stewards. This is in our blood. This is our birthright to be able to care and learn from the land directly. And so there's so much that had happened in this very short period of time between being radicalized and politicized and political organizing and commercial mushroom hunting. And I was just this fiend for information. I was a fiend for the truth, the real, real truth, like beyond it all, you know, not just what we're being told on CNN or something, or even, you know, NPR. Like I really wanted to get in there. And a part of getting in there was really this awakening, but this, oh, just pain, this pain of understanding the complexities of how traumatic things are. And so I created the For the Wild podcast, which was Unlearn and Rewild, because I needed to look for guidance. I needed to ask mentors how they were dealing with the situation. One of those women that I interviewed, her name was Diana Beresford Kroger. She's an amazing biologist and scientist who wrote a number of books, one called The Global Forest, about planting trees. So there was that little inkling. There was me spending time in these old growth forests and these clear cuts and the plantation forests, really learning about forestry. And then on top of that, and this is kind of another story, but I'll just kind of start at the end of the other story and we can get into how I ended up getting this land. But I purchased this land and I moved on living in a tent for a couple years because I didn't want to come on to raw, because I live on raw land, and raw land just means that it doesn't have running water or electricity. It hasn't been developed. The only thing that's happened here has been logging and leftover logging roads. But I didn't want to come on to this raw piece of land and say, okay, well, with my human supremacy and with my human exceptionalism, I'm going to come on and say, I'm the owner now and I'm going to do what I want. It's more like I'm going to listen to see what the other creatures want of me here and how I can actually be a good neighbor and realize that I'm the new kid on the block. So after 2 years of this very rough living, I was at the confluence
of the creek. I have a quick question. Mm-hmm. Were you living in a tent, like a camping tent, or more like a yurt style tent? Like, what level of tent was this?
I was living in a canvas tent as a soul pad. So it was probably many of you guys who are listening have heard of those. They're these canvas bell tents. Although they are water resistant, they are not waterproof. And what that means is that when they're dry and you get the first rain, all is good because the water just kind of spills off. Once it actually becomes saturated, then it leaks. And so it was a very leaky 2 years, very cold, very chilly. Hmm. Everything molded. I molded. It was just an incredible, very intense time. But I went to the confluence of the creek and the river that I live on, and it's gorgeous and it's so special just to watch the water feed into this other water system. And I got this like lightning bolt that just snapped like right really quickly. And I said, 1 million redwoods. And I was like, wait, 1 million redwoods. I'm like, what is that? And 1 million redwoods, like you're going to create a native species nursery. And I was like, okay. Like, what does that entail? What does that mean? And really what the voice was saying, the forest, this message was, you are allowed to live on this land if you plant our children. That is the reciprocal exchange that is needed to really live here in respect and love. And so then it's been this journey of a couple more years. And I've been studying restoration ecology at the University of Victoria. So I've been having an academic background to it, but really the land living here has been way more of an education than anything I could read in a textbook or sit in a classroom for. And so it's been learning how to create this native species nursery. And so there was a lot of dreams and visions until May, when I actually broke ground, so to speak, where I had these men and machines, and even I've learned how to use these machines, which I never imagined I'd ever be doing in my life.
Wait, is this May 2017?
Yeah, May 2017. So, and the machines just left about 2 weeks ago. So it's been a really intense summer of loud machines and digging and learning about soil types and building ponds and making swales and really listening to the land and being extremely flexible. Because, you know, for those of you who have taught or studied permaculture, or, you know, ecological landscaping, or, you know, wanted to develop land or build a garden. It's, you know, you can design something on paper. You can do beautiful colors. You can have a great, wonderful design with shapes and key line beds and spiral gardens. But until you actually start working with the land will tell you very clearly what will work and what won't. And you start doing something over here and the thought that you had for over there changes, because there's so much that happens when you start shifting land and you start molding land, and just the way that water will move through a landscape differently once you make even what may seem like a minor change. So there's just been so much learning and listening and flexibility and really designing as I go with how to build this nursery with permaculture principles and being as respectful and kind and creative as I can, while really understanding that any land development is hard on the land. And I prayed to the land and I talked to the land every time part of her moss would be covered up by loose soil, or when we had to clear out some of the areas on the road so that they drained this winter. And I would just go around saying, like, I will replant you. I love you. I see what's happened. Like, I'm not forgetting you. All will be healed. Like, I will be here to heal you. I'm committed to making sure that I'm around, and I'm not going to just ignore that these shifts have happened to you. So a lot of conversation, a lot of listening, a lot of changes. And now I'm to a point where I kind of have this blank canvas of these three very large ponds that I hope to be able to help with salmon restoration in. But that's a whole other topic. It's very tricky. Salmon restoration is extremely challenging because salmon are going extinct at such a rate, on top of the fact that we have warming waters and less water because of industrial farming like vineyards, cannabis, and also California steals a lot of water from Northern California to feed the Central Valley, which is a desert. So they're taking water from Mount Shasta, and they're taking water from the Eel River up in Mendocino and Humboldt to bring it down to these really water-intensive systems. And like I said, that's a whole other topic, but there's a lot of changes. So it's when we're doing restoration, and I actually am not even as interested in restoration anymore. I'm more interested in renewal, which is a different way of looking at how to help support healing earth. Like, restoration is something where you go, okay, this is a landscape. I'm going to look back 200 years and try to restore it to that point. I don't really subscribe to that anymore because we can't go back 200 years. Mm-hmm. We had a completely different climate in 200 years, and we're probably going to have a completely different climate in 10 years. So how are we actually looking forward and going, well, how do we actually support a healthy ecosystem that might be very different from what it was 200 years ago, but it's still thriving and it's still allowing biodiversity to thrive. Mm-hmm. So this renewal ecology and really paying very close attention, being quiet and being humble, is some huge lessons I've learned. But there's so many stories to go into and experiences and life lessons I've learned. But for anybody out there who's interested in this kind of work, one of the heartbreaking aspects of it is that this system, this dominant culture, capitalist system that we are all entangled in, does not make actual earth-friendly choices convenient, available, or cost-effective most of the time. So when you're building up any of these permacultures or nurseries or restoration or replanting of clear cuts, it's really something that I would like to be in more conversation with other people and going, how are we actually moving forward in the future? Are we going to be using all of, because you could have this beautiful organic permaculture and be using PVC irrigation and PVC pipes, which people like working with because it's very easy, has BPA. So are we going to be leaching BPA into the healthy organic soils of our food forest? You know, these are really big questions that are not being talked about enough, not even in the permaculture communities. And I want to be in conversation about pushing our creative limits, or the limits that we impose on our own creativity, the limits we impose on our own understanding of what is possible. And it's not to say like we're going to be perfect. It's not to say that we're going to have the solutions after a conversation or two or even a year or two. But if we don't start actually calling out the truth and at least questioning how we move forward, trying to regenerate these damaged ecosystems, then we're just going to be kept in the same track and loop of using poisonous materials and damaging the land even more. And I think with human exceptionalism, we just keep making these decisions of like, okay, well, let's just do this now. but not really understanding the consequences or even caring to look at what the consequences could be from years from now. And this time is begging more of us. This time is praying that we awaken with more empathy and thoughtfulness and that feminine understanding of how we live and breathe and work in this time.
So you're basically just like psychically answering all my questions here. It's awesome. I'll have a question and then you like answer it. But so here's something. I have a theory that, and you just touched on it in this last little bit, that, you know, awakening to feeling is really crucial in this. And even in that question of how do we move from like BPA leaching PVC pipes to some other system. And what's your input, I guess, about how opening up to feeling and grieving really play a part in this? Because I think it's kind of an overlooked, crucial piece that helps us notice where we're at and then, you know, fully feel it, the consequences of our choices, and then open up to new creativity. So that's kind of where I'm coming from with this, but I'd like to see, does that play a part in your approach to moving past these creative limits? Or what's, you know, or is it a totally different approach, you know? What is it?
No, I mean, the grieving is monumentally important because, like I was saying earlier, if you're not grieving, you're not feeling. And if you're not feeling, you're not in love. And if you're not in love, you're not going to wake up every day for the rest of your life and work for this earth, which it's going to take every day for the rest of all, everybody who's listening, it's every day for the rest of our lives. This issue of climate change and social and environmental injustices, and these are not going away. There is not a solution that's going to fix it. And so because this is such a long-term juggernaut, you know, because this is never ending in our lifetimes, I really believe that we have to be doing this work out of love and deep love, like in love, romantic love, lustful love, kinship love, family love, children love, parent love. I mean, it's all of the loves. It's all of it. It's the depth of our feeling sense. That is what keeps me going. It's, you know, it's not righteousness isn't what keeps me going. Ambition, sure, that plays a part, but that's not what actually fuels me. And so when we are like, you know, if you're in love with a family member or a friend who's passing away, you're going to feel something. You're going to feel grief. You may sit at their bedside and hold their hand and cry with them and be with them as they pass. That is what we are doing right now. That is what we need to be doing right now because, I mean, there's so many reasons for that. One, that's very important, that is very much looked over. I believe complete and firmly that the earth feels us feeling. So if we are sitting with a damaged landscape or sitting with an intact landscape or just sitting with somewhere that we find beautiful or devastating or overwhelming, and we actually allow ourselves to feel that with the land feels that with us. And the land is probably feeling like, thank goodness somebody acknowledges me. Thank goodness these creatures actually care enough to feel what I'm going through. Like, what about that? What about having empathy for the land so that the land cannot feel so alone in this time? That not only are the human species destroying them, but we don't even care to feel sad as they're being murdered and raped every day. I mean, this is reciprocity. We have to feel. We have to let them know that we are conscious, even if we still make the choices that are leading to the murder of them. At least we can be honest in it. Like, I am not a purist. I put fossil fuels in my vehicles. I use machines for this land project. I'm not a purist, but I can sit and I don't have to be in denial about it. And I'm not going to pretend like my life is eco-friendly. You know, I think we really need to examine eco-friendly and realize that there is no amount of consumer products that are going to make us eco-friendly. It doesn't matter if it's a soap that says eco-friendly. It doesn't matter if it's a cute thing at a store that says it's made with sustainable bamboo. It doesn't matter. Like, that isn't, you know, us, we can't buy our way out of this. We can't shop our way out of this. We can't bulk section our way out of it. And so I think it's like really having honesty, not so much being perfect, but at least being honest with ourselves, with the earth. And then that, at least for me, has liberated me a lot, because I don't have to pretend or hide from the truth of who I am and the choices I make. But then I can look at my choices and go, okay, this choice has these consequences, and I'm aware of that. How do I push past that? How do I push past that choice? How do I help be a part of a regenerative culture that makes these damaging choices obsolete? What would that look like? And I can start brainstorming, and I can start visioning, and I can start building community around it and loving around it. And so the grief comes in and out of all of that for me. The grief around my life, the grief around being born in this time, the grief around children, having children, not having children, like wanting to be a mother. I'm, you know, 30 years old now and having this biological clock ticking, but understanding that the world is overpopulated by humans. And the more, you know, the more humans we have, the less whales, the more humans, the less beavers, the more humans, the less of everything else, because that is what humanity does. Humanity turns every other species into more humans because we use everything as resources for our own species. So it's a lot of grief, but I don't run away from the grief because I know that is where my love is. And if I do nothing else in this life but show the earth that I love them, then that's something. That's something. And of course, I want to go beyond that. I want to put my love into action, which is the nursery, which is the podcast, which is the Tongass campaign. And I think that along with feeling and along with grieving and along with talking about things, which are all very important, the inner work, the outer work. And when I say outer work, I mean like actual tangible work, like actual, like you are using your hands to clean up oil spills. You are using your body to replant trees. You are dismantling the system. Physically speaking, we have to also do that. There's nobody who's going to do that for us. The government, corporations, the masses, they are not going to do the hard physical work for us. So if we really care, then we actually need to walk our talk. And that means a lot of things to a lot of different people. And people live in all sorts of places. And if you're in a city, great, there's things to do in cities. And if you're in the country, fantastic, there's things to do in countries. If you're in the desert, if you're in the forest, if you're in the high Sierras, I mean, it's like the work is endless. But if we don't solidify our love with action, I don't think that we are actually dedicating ourselves fully to the process. And so that's why the, you know, 1 Million Redwoods Project is so important to me, because it makes me feel like I'm actually living out my integrity and my belief systems by planting trees, by sequestering carbon, by helping with climate mitigation, by helping with rain. Trees call in rain. You know, it's an incredible process when the trees communicate with the ocean. So I really want to be a part of the emotional part and the tangible part. And along with grief, one other thing I wanted to mention was rage. I am such a fan of rage, sacred rage, passionate rage. Like, oh my gosh, like, you know, that feeling when you're so in love and you're so effing just full of it. Like, you're full of this rage of like, what the F is going on here? Yes, like I invite that with people. I invite it in myself. Like, that is fire. That is like our pure, oh my gosh, like that is energy. And let's use that energy. Let's use all of our emotions, like just how artists are able to turn heartbreak into masterpieces. Let's turn our heartbreak and our rage and our love and our sadness into a masterpiece of our reciprocal relationship with Earth.
Hey, I'm all there with you. Love that. Love it. So something I want to make sure we touch on, just because I think it can seem overwhelming for people who are, you know, quote, trying to figure out how to make their caring physical, or how to approach all of our many, many, many huge questions of the times. You know, have you been able to do this work without burnout, or is that something that, you know, you struggle with?
Funny question, as you ask, right as winter is coming and burnout is so real for me and so many of my dear friends, especially farmer friends who are at the end of the season and totally exhausted. Do I have burnout? Absolutely, 100%. I mean, the last couple of weeks I've just been half in a zombie mode and a lot of tears and sheer exhaustion. And I do think that self-care is really important, because if we want to be, and this is, you know, I have to give credit to Mila Prince for this, for talking this through with me, but she was saying, if we are the tools for the earth, we need to be sharp tools and be effective tools. And if we keep burning ourselves out, then our tool, let's say we're a knife, we get dull. And then how good are we? Not so much. So even as people who, like for me, who I look at self-care, like, okay, self-care, how does self-care actually help me be a better lover, steward, you know, relationship person with the earth? It's like, okay, well, that's a reason enough to care about ourselves and our bodies and our minds and making sure we're rested. You know, if you're exhausted and burnt out, it's pretty hard to feel a lot of creative inspiration. Mm-hmm. And we need all of that right now. We need our creative inspiration. So I definitely struggle with burnout as well, because when we're looking at what's happening on Earth and the urgency of the Anthropocene, which is the sixth mass extinction, which is what we are living through right now. We're losing and creating 200. Yeah, and creating, exactly. We're losing 200 species a day on average. It's really hard for me to be like, oh, well, I'm tired. It's like, well, I'm tired. Are you kidding me? Like, the world is on fire. People are being, you know, mutilated, and I'm tired. And I'm a privileged white person in the United States who is safe, and I'm tired. Like, my exhaustion means nothing to me in a lot of ways. And so I'm hard on myself. I don't like to give myself a lot of space to I don't like to give myself a lot of space for my own needs. And so it's definitely something that I'm struggling with. And I think a lot of activists fall into this category, and mothers and just people in general who give their life to something other than themselves. So this burnout, in one way, I see as something that I really need to work on, and other people too who are maybe listening in and feeling similarly. And I also want to say that at the end of the day, as exhausted as I am, I can go to sleep and know that I am giving my fullness to that which I love the most. And I'm giving my fullness to the highest spiritual connection that I know of. So it's kind of it's a catch 22 for me. But as winter is coming, I am praying for the long rainy days where I'm more apt to stay inside and I can't do any construction, and I have a lot of books and kittens and puppies, and I can just rest and cuddle and stay warm by the fire. So it's a really complex question for me, but I know that everyone out there needs to find rest and comfort in this time, as hard as it can be. And I also think there is this wonderful part when you are doing this work in community, that when you get burnt out and you're running as fast as you can and you're just like, oh my gosh, I can't run anymore, you can turn to your brother or your sister or your community member and say, hey, I am exhausted. Like, can I pass the baton to you? Let me rest. And then that person runs as fast as they can. So that's something really so glorious about being with humans who are aligned. Like, I have an amazing team of people that I work with at For the Wild, and they're just soulmates of mine, so brilliant. And I feel like I can have more spaciousness to rest because I have these soulmates, these community members, and can say, okay, Ayana, like, take a break, we got this. And then hopefully when I'm rested and they go, whoa, Ayana, I am exhausted, I can say, hey, friend, I got this. You take a break now. Mm-hmm. So I think we can really help each other with self-care.
Especially in that community context. And when you're talking about your project and how you're feeling, I mean, if you think about it in perspective, you kind of do have a newborn with this project. You are at this brand new stage of really doing the work. It's like you've been gestating for a couple of years, and here you've just birthed this huge baby. You know, that's kind of to be expected. So it'll be definitely interesting to watch how your relationship with this shifts as your project matures.
Yeah. And it will be I think around somewhere to 1 million to 1.5 million plants a year. So a lot of babies. I'm mother of plants, which is
mother of redwoods.
Gosh, that's such a mother of redwoods, which I'm like, that is a fantasy. That sounds so delightful. So yeah, I am interested to see how it shifts and changes, and for more people to get involved, because once the plants are to a certain maturity, which is around a year, because you don't want the plants to get too mature and root bound in pots, and they need to get planted out. You know, being able to go into these thousands of acres of clear cuts with other people to not only collect seed from the old growth forest together, but then to plant these children in the clear cuts again, and to be able to look back, you know, 10 years later, 15 years later, and realize, like, we had a literal hand in this. We had a soul in this. We were a part of regenerating Earth. And I think we all need that right now. It's such an incredibly desperate time and dark time that when we actually give ourselves to regeneration and we do something that we can look at and say, we did this, that feeds us. That is where hope is born, to see that we can actually make a difference. And so I'm so excited for the project to mature and to see all the different people that will come in and out of it, and all the different human relationships and non-human relationships that will be formed through it.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, when you're replanting the trees on the clear cuts, whose land is that, and are they at risk of being cut again?
Yeah, so there's a lot of ways to go about it. Our first partner might be the Redwood Forest Foundation, which is in the Lost Coast. They own 50,000 acres in the Usal Forest. And they do selective logging, which I have a lot of mixed feelings about. So selective logging is when you come into a mature forest. Hopefully more mature than less, even though there's people who do less mature, which isn't great because then you're just taking smaller trees. But they're impatient and greedy, which is why that happens. And so you go into a forest and you take a few. So maybe, you know, depending on how much integrity this certain logging companies have, maybe you take 30% or 50% or something like that. So
that sounds like more than a few.
Yeah. And the other part of it too, is that they have to, or they do use these large machines. So it's still damaging. Mm-hmm. Is it better than clear cutting? Absolutely. The other hard part about it is that when you go, imagine going into a rural community that is either logging or mining
or fracking or the tar sands or any of these communities up, you know, rural communities, communities of Native people. And a lot of them, you know, they're not rich folks. And you go, hey, stop logging. Hey, stop mining. Stop, stop. You're ruining, you're destroying the earth. What are you doing? Stop, 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 stop. And then you don't have any other solutions. What are these people supposed to do? They're already on the edge of poverty. And then you take away their one income source from the land that they and their families have probably been working for hundreds of years. That's a conundrum. Mm-hmm. That is something that we really need to, especially people who are wanting to be a part of the solution. We need to have solutions in place as we discuss with people who are extracting the resources for the people who are, you know, separated from it. I mean, it's funny. It's like a lot of people who protest a lot of these resource extractive industries, yet they actually live off the resources that are extracted. So it's a very complex issue. And I am not pro-logging at all. I mean, I am very much not pro-logging, but I am pro-community health. And so the selective logging, I don't feel great about. I think it is a step in a direction of some type of acknowledgement that we shouldn't be clear cutting anymore. So it's something, it's not great. And so this forest, particularly that I'm talking about, they do selective logging. They don't do it as hard as other logging companies. They also don't use poison on tan oaks, which is huge. A lot of logging companies in the Redwood region use something called a mazapir, like the Mendocino Redwood Company that's owned by the Fisher family, who owns Banana Republic and Victoria's Secrets and Gap. They also are the biggest landholders in Mendocino and Humboldt counties, I believe. And they go around and use this poison called a mazapir on the tan oaks, which then gets into the water and it poisons the fish and it poisons people. I mean, it's a terrible killer, you know, side. It kills these tan oak trees because they're trying to maximize their profits by only having redwoods grow. So any other tree in that forest, they want to kill. And so that's, you know, and what I like about the Redwood Forest Foundation is they're like, well, we're not going to use a mazapir, but what if we take some of the tan oaks down, not all of them, because tan oaks are also important, and we turn it into biochar. And then it's giving the community work. It's giving loggers work by cutting down some of the tan oak. But then it's creating a secondary product that's actually used for carbon and water sequestration in gardens. So then it might cut down on water usage for cannabis farms or vineyards. And then it's like, okay, well, this is interesting. See, this is a creative solution. It might not still be a perfect solution, but at least somebody is trying something new that is towards regeneration and mm-hmm. towards forest health. So, sorry, that's a long answer to just one part of it. So that might be one, that might be one place that we replant, but also private land holdings, national forest. I very much am, anybody I partner with, I would have it contracted that whatever we replant would never be cut. Mm-hmm. I'm also not just interested in replanting trees. I want to plant the understory plants because to create a healthy ecosystem, you need all the cast of characters. It's not just the one keystone tree. It's all of it. You know, it's all of the beautiful relational elements of the fungi and the mycelium going underground and the huckleberry that's next to the redwood, that's next to the, you know, sword fern. I mean, all these relationships actually play a huge role in forest health and any ecosystem health. So definitely looking into building more relationships with private and public land holdings so that we can just keep replanting every year, putting out millions of trees and recovering thousands of acres of damaged land.
Wow. It's such a beautiful vision. And as someone who is a lover of trees and who studied a lot of this stuff in undergrad, I'm just like, wow, thank you for the work you do. And a question that's coming up that I would love to hear what you have to say about is, how can people, no matter where they live in the world, how can they, you know, take this passion that you have and take whatever it's lighting up in them and put it to work where they live?
It's a beautiful question. I've just been seeing so many visions coming to my mind. I think there's a, you know, for people who want to get involved in their own passion, I'd say start today. Don't wait another moment. Don't be too hard on yourself. You know, you don't have to know all the answers. You don't have to be an expert. You don't even have to know exactly what you're doing. Just show up, start researching, start getting engaged, start learning the people who have already been doing the things that you want to do, learn from them, be humble, offer your support. You know, it's as simple as, you know, maybe somebody listens to this podcast and they say, gosh, like I live in the Everglades and I really care about the Everglades, and, you know, Google Everglade restoration, Everglade protection, Google the grassroots frontline communities that are being affected by, you know, lack of Everglades and floodings from storms. I mean, like it's kind of, you know, you start looking into, how do I say this? No, it's like you start pulling one thread. Mm-hmm. Like I started pulling the thread of forestry, and then, oh my gosh, the web just unravels into seeing how it's all connected to everything else. So I'd say for people who are interested in their passions, like, just start, be humble, and be intersectional with how you understand your own passion, because all of our passions are connected and it's beautiful. It's so wonderful to have that. So as much as like I'm focused on a part, I'm not restoring every ecosystem, but I want to support people in those other ecosystems. I want to support my comrades while still staying focused on my own path. And so I think there's a lot of spaciousness that we need to give ourselves and each other when we're stepping into these passions. I think there's a lot of education and learning how to communicate, learning how to listen to differences, and just being able to sometimes be still and be quiet and listen to the land, or listen to a city hall meeting, or listen to people on the front lines who are telling their stories, being able to have so much empathy and courage. Like it is a very courageous thing to step into your passion in this time. And as much as it's courageous, it's also totally mandatory if you want to live a fulfilled life. I don't think that we can actually be fulfilled with having narcissistic paths. If we're only concerned about ourselves and our own glory, I think that's a really empty way to live. And I think there's this chronic dissatisfaction that comes with that. And that's why there's such this intense urge and addiction to consume, an addiction to be on, like whether it's consuming social media, consuming shopping, consuming food, whatever it is. I mean, we're trying to fill the void. I mean, we're seeing it all over the world, especially in this country. We're trying to fill the void of actually dedicating ourselves to something that we believe in and feeding our passion and feeding our creativity. And so for anybody who's out there going, gosh, like I really want to step into my passion, I'd say run as fast as you can towards your passion. Run as fast as you can towards your own fear that you're not good enough or you can't do it. Look straight at those voices, or look straight at that fear and go, I see you, fear. I see you. And here you are, but that doesn't mean it needs to stop me. I can, you know, I'm so much about running straight for the eye of the storm, because I think once we get there and we're actually in the eye of the storm, or we're actually sitting in our deepest fear, we go, oh, okay, interesting. That's our fear. Huh. That's good to know. Now we can move on. Now we can actually confront it. And this other, metaphor that I think about a lot with starting with your passion is, it's that feeling where you're at the edge of the cliff, or you're about to like jump in to that big swimming hole, you know, below you. And you don't know how you're going to land, but you jump anyways. And you just figure it out. And you jump in and it's cold and you swim to the edge and it's invigorating. You're like, wow, I just did that. And so we don't need to have it all figured out. We can't have it all figured out. We're just humans. We're never going to have it all figured out. So if that's something that's stopping you, don't worry about it. If something's stopping you, like your family or your friends, or you're scared you're going to isolate or ostracize yourself, or you're nervous to risk comfort, or loss of relationships, or you're scared to risk a lifestyle that you once had. I have done that. I have risked all of those things. I have risked my comfort and my lifestyle and my family and some of my friends. And it was challenging to push myself through that. But ultimately, being on the flip side and now having the confidence in who I am and what my passions are, a lot of those people came back around. They're like, oh, wow, she's not some, you know, kooky person. Well, I am that kooky person, but you know, I think the more confidence you have in your own passion and the more you just do it, then the people and the other comforts that you gave up, it's like the people come back around maybe and go, wow, this person's really just doing it. And they can actually relax and trust in you that you are aligned with your life's purpose. And then in terms of the other comforts that you might risk by jumping into your passion, they don't matter anymore. Like, what would I rather live? A fully impassioned, engaged, enlivened life, or have certain comforts of modernity that are killing the earth? I mean, it's like a no-brainer at this point. Like, I don't even want those things. So there's a lot there, but I'm so excited for more people to engage with their passion. And I can just imagine a world where more and more people get on board and we're all working with each other in our impassioned places, and how exciting that is. And like, talk about pushing the boundaries of creativity when the more people are just fully embodied and we get to connect from that place.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. And I hope, listeners, that you will take heed to this wonderful advice here. And maybe for our secret episode, we can tap into how you came to acquire this land, to be in partnership mm-hmm. with it, and what it's been like to live there and work on it and do all of this actual physical hands-on work. What do you think?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Cool.
And before we get into that, we'll do that in the secret episode. And before we get into that, I just want to ask you to share where people can find out more about you. You, of course, have your amazing podcast, For the Wild, which used to be Unlearn and Rewild, for people who are maybe have skimmed the podcasts a while back and haven't checked back in. And where can people find you, and what do you offer, and what, yeah, tell us all, tell us everything.
Okay. Well, yeah, so it was Unlearn and Rewild. And after I unlearned and rewilded, I realized that I wanted to devote myself for the wild. So that's how the name change came to be. And you can find the podcast, the 1 Million Redwoods Project, the Tongass National Forest Campaign, and many other things on forthewild.world. Also, the webinar series, the reactive webinar series I'm doing about responses to climate change. It's all there. We also just became a fiscally sponsored organization, so we can actually receive tax-deductible donations now.
Awesome.
Which is huge, because we really need financial support to do these replantation projects and to keep the momentum of this incredible forestry project going. So that's been a really big leap for us. And
it's the end of the year, folks. Go give the rest of your tax go give some donations.
Yes. Yeah. And we're, you know, podcast, we're going to be launching a Kickstarter or a crowdfunding campaign in November. And also, I think it's called Patreon for the podcast in November. And the podcast is just still blowing my mind. Had an interview recently with Clayton Thomas Mueller, who's a Indigenous activists from Ottawa, Canada, and we talked about radical land distribution and wealth distribution and climate change and beyond intersectionality. And he's just a fascinating man. And so there's a lot of great podcasts coming up. And then our first live event will be on December 2nd in San Francisco. And you can also find that on forthewild.world. And Bronte Valise and myself will be facilitating an event on responses to climate change and grief and then action. So it's going to be a really beautiful time where we can get together with around 45 to 50 other folks and share what's going on for us and how we can all move forward together as a community. So I'm really excited about that. And so those are a bit of everything, and there's more to come, and definitely little secret projects that will be released starting next year. So check us out and feel free to email engage at forthewild.world with any questions. And yeah, thank you all so much for sharing this time with Natalie and I.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. Thank you so much, Ayanna, for coming on the show. And listeners, check out forthewild.world to learn more about all of that. Sign up for their newsletter to stay in touch. Check them out on Instagram, wherever. Just get in touch, stay engaged. And you can check out our secret episode at dreamfreedombeauty.com/secret and go have a listen to learn more about Ayanna's experience with coming into partnership with this land and what it's been like to live and work on it. Thank you so much, Ayanna, and it was just so awesome. I wish we could have talked for like 5 hours, but you know, maybe we'll just have to have you back again.